Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here, and we're going to take a look at your taxes today. Lots of things you can still do before the end of the year. Mary Mellum is here to help us out. She's a tax professional from Green Bay, has been in the tax business for 30 years. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. And in addition to servicing 1,200 or so tax and accounting clients during the year, their business also includes tax consulting for other tax professionals, as well as teaching tax seminars around the country. Mary, great to have you back.
Nice to be here, Larry.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to have you with us. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. You may have a tax question, and if you do, I hope you'll join in. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question on our Facebook page, our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Well, there's still a few days left. We've got about 10 days, haven't we?
Yes.
Mary, frankly, there's still quite a bit we could do.
Well, there are certain things that you need to do before the end of the year. There are a few things that you can do next year, you know, before April 15th, that will help. But it's best to get it done before December 31st for the most part.
I just paid my property taxes.
That was a good thing, I hope.
Yeah, well, it was hard to rate that check, but in the on the other end, I get to deduct all. Well, I get to claim that as a deduction for my taxes.
That's correct. As long as property taxes are paid on or before December 31st, they are deductible in the current year. Some people, however, play games, so to speak, and deduct double up, pay one in January and one in December, so that they get more itemized deductions in one year and maybe don't itemize the next year.
So that's a way to do it. I know someone else who actually on the couple's charitable donations, they do that, do all their charitable donations one year and then the next year take a...
That's correct. When we recommend that to people in certain circumstances, if you're always going to itemize, you don't do that. But if you're close to the edge of itemizing, then doubling up on things in one year will be a better tax benefit. It'll make you itemize in one year, and then you use the standard deduction the next year. And in that year that you're itemizing, you're going to pay your medical bills, you're going to make your charitable contributions, you're going to, if you have a have a mortgage interest, you might pay one an extra payment at the end of the year rather than waiting until the next day, so you could possibly get 13 payments in one year instead of the normal 12. So some things you can do to help you out there.
The tax extender bill was passed. It's been in recent news. How does that affect us as taxpayers?
If you're a business person, it added some clarity before the end of the year. For the normal taxpayer, the non-business person, there really weren't a lot of things that were in the extender bill that affected people. They did, the individual, that is.
Yeah.
They did extend the energy credit for the personal person, the small energy credit, I believe, but it was at a $500 level. It's not a whole lot different, and if you've used it before, it's going to be the same thing. You've got the five-year, $500 lifetime limitation, and that was extended. So someone who put in a new furnace that has never used the energy credit before would be able to take advantage of that.
All right.
One of the big things that did get extended, though, we're still having people that are having problems with their mortgages. And if your house went into foreclosure and the house did not satisfy all of the debt by taking back the house, there has been an exclusion for the debt that is canceled as a result of the foreclosure. And that was set to expire in 2014, and they did extend that.
Okay.
So that's good news to anyone who's in the foreclosure issue. And then there was also an extension of the tuition deduction on the front page of the tax return.
Yep.
And that is one of the alternatives to the education credits. We have the HOPE, which is called the American Opportunity Credit, and the Lifetime Learning Credit, and then we had the tuition deduction. And with those other two credits, the tuition deduction was primarily used for students who were doing master's or doctorate work. And so that's been extended. So that's a good news for them.
So a few things out of there, and of course small businesses, which we won't get into today, but there's some clarity, I think, for small businesses, as reading it at least.
Yes.
That helps in many ways.
There were two other things that were made permanent that do affect the individual. One of the two, actually three things. One of the two is earned income credit, and it was not set to phase out yet. It would have been 2016, but they were ahead of the game for a change. And so if you have people with earned income credit, there has been a higher amount if you had three or more children and a higher phase out for married couples filing joint. That was extended permanently. So we aren't going to have that yo-yo wondering if it's going to go away. Also, the American Opportunity Credit, which was the four-year credit as opposed to the HOPE credit, which was the two,
mm-hmm.
that also has been extended permanently.
Okay.
So that's good news for college students. And then two last things, actually. The educator deduction, the teachers that were allowed $250 as an adjustment on their front page, for all our teachers, they need to make sure they have their receipts so that we can claim that deduction, because that, too, was made permanent.
Okay.
And then one last personal thing is the state tax or sales tax deduction. For people who maybe don't pay into the state during the year that's still itemized, they were able to take a sales tax deduction. And the sales tax is the greater of the sales tax or the amount of income tax, state and local income tax.
There we go.
So there have been some things that Congress worked ahead this time, which was good.
All right. Chris in Milwaukee has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Chris. Thank you for calling.
Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I have a son in college, and I'm wondering if I can still make a contribution to a 529 plan to use for his tuition as we continue his college career.
That's a very good question, Chris, and the answer is yes. The 529 plans allow you to make a contribution up to April 15th of the following year, so for the prior year. So you could put in up to the $3,000 amount into the 529 plan. And I say the $3,000 amount, that's not technically correct, but the $3,000 is the amount that you could deduct on the Wisconsin return.
And then you could
put more money into the 529 depending on the state plan. Federal has no deduction for it, but it does grow tax-free.
Okay, but I'm not worried about the growth. I wanted to take the deduction.
The deduction is on the Wisconsin return. It's a Wisconsin benefit only, and it is up to $3,000,
and
you can make it up to April 15th.
I don't have to leave it in there for a certain amount of time?
It really doesn't make any difference as long as it's used for qualified educational expenses.
Okay, that sounds great then. Thank you.
All right. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post on our Facebook page, and our Facebook page title is The Larry Mueller Show. So we'd certainly love to hear from you as we visit with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband David operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals and are enrolled agents. So it's always great to have her come by great to have you listening in. And again, join in with your questions or comments. charitable donations. I still have actually one more to do, and I'm going to do it by credit card because I'm running out of time. And I imagine charitable donations, if you're going to count them for this year, you have to.
Charitable donations are a tricky little thing, and you're exactly right. You need to make sure you donate them by the end of the year. If you are writing a check and that check is dated by December 31st and it is mailed, post-stamped by that, because that's sometimes how the organization looks at it, and you have enough money in your checking account to cover it, then you would be allowed a charitable contribution for the current year. Charitable contributions are a sticky little area because no matter the size of the charitable deduction, you need proof. When it gets into $250 or more to any organization, you need to have proof that is also in the form of a thank you letter from the organization acknowledging the donation. So that's the one that catches people sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. The places where I contribute are pretty good about getting you get something in the mail, a letter, thank you letter, and it's kind of nice to see the thank you anyway, but then put that in with your other tax materials.
And here's the little catch. If you are filing your tax return and you haven't received the thank you letter yet, it's not going to count because the letter has to be received by you before you file your income tax return for the year that's containing that donation.
Let's take a trip to Shawano County and talk with Peggy next. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. Thanks for this good show. Good information.
Thank you.
I have a question about independent contractors. My friend has an opportunity to have a job that makes her an independent contractor. She provides a service. The money is paid to the manager who manages other people in the providing the service, and except that when you're designated an independent contractor, nothing's deducted from your check. That's your responsibility. Is that true?
Okay. An independent contractor is someone who is a business owner.
Uh-huh.
They are in their own business. As such, they generally file a Schedule C to report that income. They take their deductions against it, and the bottom line of that income is subject to self-employment tax.
Okay.
A person who works for somebody gets a paycheck from that company. That company is going to deduct FICA and Medicare tax, and they're also going to match that amount.
Mm-hmm.
The Social Security tax that the business owner is responsible for is the total amount, both the employer and the employee part. So as an independent contractor, there is more money coming that she is responsible for paying, or he is responsible for paying to the government because they are their own employer.
Right. Okay.
There is a fine line, however, in what you're telling me. You have to be very careful to make sure that that person, as a business person, you have to be very careful that you are really an independent contractor and not an employee that's been called an independent contractor.
Yeah, that was the mystery for me.
The government has a set of rules. They have about 1985, they came out with something called the 20-question test that asks certain questions about who controls the person, who collects the money, who's responsible for providing the tools to do the job, who can be hired and fired, and that kind of thing. And that 20 questions helped tell people which side of the coin they were on. They have later consolidated those 20 questions into three major areas, but they contain all of those 20 questions. So if someone is incorrectly treating someone as an independent contractor and the state or the federal would come in and challenge that, those people could face penalties for mischaracterization.
Where do you find these questions?
If you go to the IRS website, that's IRS, www.irs.gov, and in their search box, type in independent contractors, you will find a list of those questions.
Excellent.
Okay. I'll recommend that to her because to me it sounds kind of...
Didn't sound quite right, yeah. Well,
there are some industries that do that when it's not proper, and they have been challenged. The state unemployment or the state workman's comp area is very good at looking into these situations.
All right. Thanks, Peggy, for calling. I appreciate your call. We have more callers online, but still an open line for you at 1-800-642-1234 as we visit about your taxes with Mary Mellum of Eschwabenden Tax Professionals, Green Bay, Wisconsin. I'm Larry Mueller. Cheyenne Lentz, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Right now, visiting with Mary Mellum about your taxes, Tony in Madison has a question, so let's go to Tony. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. We sold our home of over 25 years last year, and I am currently a Florida resident. My wife is a Wisconsin resident, and I am curious how the state of Wisconsin is going to tax that transaction.
Okay. First of all, Tony, for I assume you and your wife own the home jointly and
correct.
It's located in Wisconsin?
Correct.
Okay. If it's located in Wisconsin, is it your permanent residence? Let's talk about your wife for a minute. Is this residence the permanent location that you live here more than half the year for your wife, who is the Wisconsin resident?
She probably does here more than half of the year, correct.
Does she hold a Wisconsin driver's license and report this and vote in Wisconsin and things like that?
Correct, she does.
Okay. For her, it would be the sale of the principal residence, and generally the sale of the principal residence that you have owned and occupied for 2 out of the last 5 years is excludable from tax.
Okay.
As long as the gain is not more than $250,000, which most of us in Wisconsin don't have that problem.
Yeah.
Now, when, Tony, did you become a Florida resident?
Well, almost 3 years ago.
Almost 3 years ago?
Right.
Prior to that time, were you a Wisconsin resident?
Yes.
Okay. If you were a Wisconsin, if from the time you sell the house, if you look back for 5 years, if you were a Wisconsin resident for 2 out of those 5 years and you owned and lived in that house as your principal residence for 2 out of the 5 years, you will be okay and the gain won't be taxable. If you don't meet those 2 out of 5 years, then your half of the house will be taxable to Wisconsin as a second home. And you would have to pay Wisconsin tax as a non-resident.
Okay. I was led to believe that once I left the state, it becomes taxable to me, but that's not correct.
Not necessarily.
No.
First of all, the house has to be sold, and then you do the look-back period to see what you're selling. Were you selling your principal residence, or were you selling your second home? Principal residence, if you were a resident at that time, will be okay. Second residence, of course, will be taxable.
There we go.
Yeah, since my wife is a Wisconsin resident and I'm a Florida resident, she needs to file a Wisconsin tax return. I do not.
Again, depending on what that transaction is to you, I would suggest that either way, you should file the Wisconsin return and report if it's non-taxable to show that it's non-taxable. You'll avoid any questions. Wisconsin does look at residency and to make sure that you really are or aren't a resident with regard to this transaction.
So if you live there for two solid years, you're going to be okay in terms of the, you'd be there 2 out of 5 years.
Yes. If in this 5 years, the 2 years before you became a Florida resident, this was your home located in Wisconsin, then the exclusion would apply to you. Mm-hmm. If it wasn't, then you're going to pay taxes on property located in another state from the state of residence, and you would have to file a Wisconsin non-resident form for that.
There we go. Good luck, Tony. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Allison and Racine up next with a question. Hi, Allison. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I had another question about the 529. I'm not sure if you can answer this for me or not, but I was wondering if you open a 529, if your child eventually ends up attending university abroad, can you use those funds, or is there some sort of rule that bars you from doing that?
The 529 plan is available for education at any college that is a college that would accept FAFSA.
Oh, okay.
So usually when they're attending a college abroad, now your situation may be different, but many of the times when the students, when they study abroad, it is connected to a college here. You know, mm-hmm. if they are going abroad and, you know, studying in London or Paris, and it's strictly that, those 529 plans would not help. But if they go to the university, say UWGB, and they have a connection with a college in London or somewhere else, and you are going through that college to get there, then the answer that would be that the 529s would be eligible.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Steve in Sparta, let's turn to you next. Hi, Steve.
Hello there.
What can we do for you?
My question is pertains to a 529 as well. I am 64 years old, and I have a daughter that's attending college. But we have a 529 set up for her. But I'm going to be needing to take money out of an IRA to supplement helping her with her school. So would it be benefit tax? I realize I'm going to have to pay tax on the money I take out of my IRA, but would I be better off if I take it all out, put it into the 529, and then take it out of the 29 and pay the school?
Okay, let me get back to what's going on. This is your daughter that is attending college?
Yes.
Okay, and you do have a 529 plan set up for her?
Yes.
Okay. And did you contribute this year's money into that 529 plan yet?
No.
Okay. And so what your question is what's in the 529 plan now is not enough to pay the college, and
right.
you need to take additional amounts out.
That's correct. And I don't plan on doing it. I've already taken money out of there to buy a fishing boat this year, so I don't plan on taking any more out of there. But in January, I'm going to take some out. And then I was thinking I would just put it into her 529, and then when her tuition came due in 2016, I would take it out of 529. Hey.
I think that's a good idea. Any money that you take out of the IRA, as long as it's not a Roth IRA, is going to be taxable unless you have some prior after-tax contributions, and then it's not a dollar-for-dollar thing. So if you take money out of the IRA, you're going to pay taxes on it regardless.
Yeah.
If you're taking it out just to make a contribution to the 529 plan, maybe you would take out more than you needed to, and that wouldn't necessarily be a good thing. The 529 plan is going to bring growth if it's in there long enough, but if you're going to take it out and take it out of the IRA, put it into the 529 plan, and immediately take it out of the 529 plan, you're probably not gaining anything.
Okay. All right.
Why is I not gaining anything?
Yeah, I would, you know, not knowing your tax situation, whether taking money out of the IRA is going to be taxable if you take out too much, it's kind of a tough question to say how much should you take out of the IRA or, you know, take out of the 529 plan or whatever. So you probably should talk to someone before you do this, given your particular tax situation.
Yeah, sit down with a professional somewhere. Thanks a lot for calling. Good luck, Steve. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. A couple of, there's some emails and Facebook questions. So let's go to those. Ruth Ann wonders, is there on Facebook, is there any circumstance that allows anyone to file a tax return every other year?
Well, the answer to that is if you have income above the filing requirement every other year, that would be the situation. You do not have to file a tax return, or the reason you don't file a tax return is because you do not have income in excess of the filing requirement. So there isn't an election to say, oh, I'll put it all in next year and avoid 1 year. So only if the circumstances put you in, I have income above the filing requirement 1 year and not income above the filing requirement the next year. That would be the only every other year that would be available.
An email question. Could you briefly discuss the concept of minimum required distributions, MRDs, for pre-tax retirement accounts?
Sure. The minimum required distribution rules say that generally when someone reaches the age of 70 and a half, technically the maximum date is April 1st of the year following the year you turn 70 and a half. But if you look at it as that point when you turn 70 and a half, you are required to start taking money out of your IRA or your company pension plan. There is a table that is set up that tells you what the minimum amount is that you have to take out, and it's based on your age. And if a person were age 70 and a half, the divisor on that table would be 27.4. That means that you look at the account balance the prior year, at the end of the prior year, you divide it by 27.4, and that says that is the least amount of money that you must take out of that IRA or that pension to satisfy the minimum required distributions.
Now, John, in an email, who is past 70 and a half, has been working full-time and was told that he did not have to, was not required to take money out because he was working full-time.
There is an exception in what he's saying, and that is if you are working for the company that you have a company pension plan, your money coming out of that company pension plan can be put off until you retire. That, however, does not apply to any IRA money that you would have.
Gotcha. Okay. Alec in Eau Claire has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Alec. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. Okay, so I have an uncle who lived in New Richmond, Wisconsin. He not only willed to me, my brother, and my sister, but I have a transfer. I have a Todd. He died and left me the house. And I was wondering if I sell that house, I never lived in it, never anything like that, if that money is taxable.
Okay. Now, this is your uncle who willed you his house.
He willed me the house, and then for some people it matters. I do have a transfer on death deed.
Okay. But you were not the owner of that house in any capacity before he died?
Not that I am aware of.
Okay. All right. The sale of that house is a taxable event. So, yes, you will have to report the sale. because the sale document will come in your name, and I'm assuming you receive the money. But here's the benefit. If you inherited this money as opposed to having received it as a prior gift, if you inherited the house, then whatever it was worth on the date that your uncle died is what we call your cost basis in that. And the difference between the sales price and your cost basis would be the gain. And in most people's case, when they sell a property that they have inherited and it's sold relatively close to the time they die, that person died, there is no gain.
So you pay no taxes. So,
that is correct.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. I've had too many people explain it to me in legalese, and it made no sense.
Well, I'm glad it made some sense then.
Thanks a lot, Alec, for calling. Appreciate it. Michelle in Boulder Junction. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My husband and I both have full-time jobs with health insurance and benefits and whatnot. We also have a side business, and we claim income from that side business and expenses from it. And we also have a business checking account for it. When I file taxes, we're always charged a self-employment tax. And I don't understand why that is, because our main jobs, you know, we're only sort of very part-time self-employed on the side. Is there a way to get around that, or is that, and if not, if I went to claiming that income as hobby instead, would that trigger some sort of audit?
Okay. Let's take one step at a time here.
Okay.
As a full-time person, you do pay into the Social Security system. There
yes.
is a max dollar amount that if your earnings are more than a certain dollar amount, you would not have to pay any more into FICA tax. That
okay.
dollar amount is about $118,000. For, I believe, $118,005 is about the number. So if your full-time job for each one of you independently is not more than that, then you will pay into the Social Security system up to that point before anything would stop. And when you pay into the Social Security system, it encompasses all of your jobs or all of your independent contractor or business income.
Okay.
So if you have not exceeded that amount, you will pay in. Medicare
okay.
is a separate animal, and Medicare has no cap on it. So as long as you have earned income, you will pay into the Medicare system for both types of incomes.
Okay.
Now, to address the other part of the situation, if you have a side business, now, if you have a business on your tax return, I assume that the business is in one of your names rather than both names.
Yes.
Okay. So that person is looking at that income. What the government looks at, it says if you are in business, you are your employer and your employee, therefore you pay into the Social Security system.
Uh-huh.
If you are in and you operate that business with the intent to make a profit and on a regular and continuous basis.
Okay.
The only way for it to be considered a hobby is if you're doing it, let's say, for fun more than intending to make a profit on it. And, you know, maybe you're just doing it because you enjoy doing it and somebody pays you for something that you enjoy doing. If that's the case, then it could be a hobby, and with the hobby, you report the income as other income on the front page of your tax return. If you have any deductions against that income, they are miscellaneous itemized deductions subject to 2%. They belong on a Schedule A. So what it means is you're basically reporting the income, and may or may not get any deductions against it. If it is truly a hobby, there is no self-employment tax that is owed on hobby income.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle, for calling. Appreciate your call. Email question for Mary. Can you talk about the ABLE Act and putting aside money for special needs children? Not sure of the status of that in Wisconsin, Mary says.
The ABLE accounts are a new item, and I will mention what I know about that. There is currently something called a trust, a special needs trust, and a special needs trust is a trust, i.e. that's set up with money like inherited money or something like that, that goes into an account, and it's operated as a trust. And out of that account, you can pay for that disabled person something that Medicare or their social programs, Medicaid, would not pay. And this special account doesn't cause them to lose Medicare, their Medicaid or whatever. Doesn't count as income against them. These ABLE accounts that were created, I believe, to be an extra way or another way of doing the same thing. And I know for a federal level, they were created, and there hasn't been a whole lot of information or discussion about it. I do not know if the state of Wisconsin has taken any position on that at all yet. One thing I do caution people about is that as these accounts are set up, sometimes people think, if I put this money into the account and that person dies, I'll be able to get it back out. And that sometimes depends on the government and how, you know, extra money has been paid for them as a subsidy. And I guess what I would say is, if that's your idea, don't expect to get it back out. Live on the side, and if you do, you know, that's a plus.
Mary Mellum, our guest today, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your taxes today with Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who operates Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals with her husband, David. I'm Larry Mueller. Questions, call in 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Corey in Watertown has a question, so let's go there. Hi, Corey. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Mary. I got just a little weird predicament. I make like $18,000 a year. Not a big breadwinner. Last year I filed my taxes, but the year prior to that, for one reason or another, it didn't get done. And I was wondering what I could do, and if it's even worth filling them out, since I would have to pay like late fees and stuff, and I'd probably only get $100 back or $200 anyway. So,
was it about the same amount as you earned the year before this year, Corey?
Yeah, about that.
Okay.
Corey, how old are you? Let me ask it this way. Are you under 65?
Yes.
Okay. If you are under 65, your filing requirement is probably around $10,000. And so you would be required to file if you made $18,000 of earning. Now, I assume you haven't heard from the government about that, about not filing that year?
No.
Okay. It may be that you haven't heard from them. Did you have withholding on your $18,000?
No, but I always get money back at the end of the year. I never owe.
Okay. Is this $18,000 possibly from a self-employed business rather than working for someone?
No.
Okay. Well, if based on an $18,000 number, there is a filing requirement. Even if you don't have money, even if you have money coming back, you're still required to file. If you have money coming back, there wouldn't be, for federal purposes, any late penalties unless they decided that you were, you know, fraudulent or something like that. The state of Wisconsin does have a late filing penalty that they automatically charge. They deduct it from any refund that you would have. But my recommendation would be that you file the 2013 return. The statute of limitations on collections or on assessment of taxes is a three-year statute of limitations, and it doesn't start if you never file the return. So if there's anything that would come up later, like 10 years later, if you don't file that return, they could come back, you know, and question what's going on. So I would strongly recommend that you file it, and then you'll have no questions.
Yep.
Is there any special form I have to send with my paperwork?
No, you would just do the same thing that you would do in any other year that you were filing. It's just that...
It's late.
Yep.
It's just that it's late, yes.
Yep.
And Wisconsin will deduct, I believe it's a $50 late fee that they will deduct out of any refund.
Thank you very much.
Government, probably not.
Yeah. There we go. Good luck, Corey. Get it filed and be done with it. Let's put it that way. Why not? Oh, man. Bob in Amherst has a question next. Let's go there. Bob, hi. Thanks for calling.
Well, thank you for taking my call. One point on the 529. I believe last year it was applicable, and certainly would be this year. The amount for state income tax deduction was increased from $3,000 to $3,100.
Last year it was indexed for inflation. So it's a $3,000 base, and it goes up. So you're correct about that, that each year it will change.
Okay. And also, I believe in order for it to be a state income tax deduction, it has to be through a 529 that's tied into Wisconsin.
For the Wisconsin deduction, it is only eligible from two sources. It's called EdVest or Tomorrow Scholar. Those are the only two places that will give you the Wisconsin deduction.
Yeah. Oh, I see. And Tomorrow Scholars, that's just available via the Internet?
Tomorrow Scholar, in what I have gathered, the Tomorrow Scholar is the program that I usually see where people are dealing with an account, a financial planner. And the EdVest program is the one that you go in and do yourself online.
Okay.
There we go. All right. Good. Thanks a lot for calling, Bob. Appreciate it. Here's a fun comment from Carol and Dave in Wisconsin Rapids, who said, last year when Mary was on your show, we turned it on just in time to learn that our long-term care premium was deductible in Wisconsin. We saved a tidy amount from this information and are hoping the same deduction is still available for this year. Thanks, Mary.
Well, to David and Carol, Merry Christmas, because it still is available.
There we go.
And I'm glad that they found that out.
Yeah, and they learned about it right here on the show. That's wonderful. And good to know that it's still available. Amelia in Madison, it's your turn next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, yes. So I was wondering, I had owned a house. I'm on SSDI, it's Social Security Disability Income.
Okay.
And I had owned a house for 13 years in Madison, and I had tenants living in that house for extra income, which I always claimed or declared or put on my taxes.
Yep.
And then I sold my house in May, and I bought a three-unit small rental property. And so I'm wondering if Mary thinks that I will have capital gains taxes.
Let's talk a little bit about the sale. First of all, the house that you sold and purchased a new one, did you physically get the money from the sale of the house and then go through a broker or something and use that money yourself to buy the new property?
Yes, I used the money from the sale of the house. I did not have any other money. I used the money from the sale of the house to put down.
Opposed to... Do these terms mean anything, like-kind exchange or qualified intermediary?
I don't know what they mean.
Okay. If you haven't heard those, then you probably didn't do that. the like-kind exchange through a qualified intermediary is a way to go from one property to the next without recognizing the gain at that time. If you did not use that tool, then the sale of the house would be a taxable event, and the purchase of the new house would have a cost basis in it equal to whatever you happen to pay for it. So if you did not use a like-kind exchange, you will need to report that sale, and if there is any taxes paid, which usually, if there is any gain on it, which usually because a rental property has depreciation that is claimed each year, it lowers your basis, your cost in that property, to the point where there is oftentimes a gain at the sale of that property.
So isn't there something about that it was my primary residence because I was living in it?
We're renting out a house, so how is this a duplex that you're renting?
Where you did live. Where I lived before, it was a single family house, and I lived in it.
And you rented a bedroom,
perhaps.
Okay.
If you rented a bedroom out and you claimed the income on the rental, then again, it depends on the depreciation that you took, because if it is your principal residence that you sold, you do get a deferral or an exclusion on that. But if there is depreciation that was allowed or allowable on that property, that portion of the home, there is gain due to that.
Mm. Okay. And I didn't take any depreciation.
Depreciation rule says whether it was allowed or allowable. Just because you didn't take advantage of it the government won't give you a pass on it. So again, it's probably something that you should talk to a professional about to see what you can do to maximize the use of that.
Yeah, it may mean, depending on the amount, it could mean refiling taxes from previous years, perhaps, Mary?
Well, you can't refile for depreciation.
Okay.
There is a change of accounting method that does allow you to get back or to use that depreciation in the current year. But again, I would recommend that you get a tax professional to talk about those things. And then certainly the purchase of the new property, I think you said it was a three-person or a three-unit.
Yes, it's a three-unit.
And are you living in one of the three units?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, one of those units is qualifying for potentially the sale of a principal residence. The other two units would be rentals, like standalone rental type things, where you're going to run into the same situation should you, first of all, with the depreciation on the income from those, and then if you sell it in the future, you're going to run into the same situation.
Yeah, there you go. Good luck, Amelia. Thanks so much, and probably it is a very good idea for you to look at a tax professional in the Madison area.
Yes, I think that's a wonderful idea.
Yeah, thanks, Amelia. And Carla in La Crosse, your turn. Thanks, Carla, for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, I have two questions. One is, how late can you invest in an IRA and still take that off your upcoming taxes? And then the other question is, can I take that money, if it's not an employer contribution, can I use other money, like I can use it for my checking account, can I take a loan, could I use a gift?
Okay, I think you're asking, well, first of all, let me address the date. You are able to contribute to an IRA, a deductible IRA, up to April 15th of 2016, as long as you tell them the contribution is for 2015.
Okay.
The next thing is, it doesn't matter where you get the money to put into that IRA. You can get it as a gift from someone. You can take out a loan for it. You can have it in your checking account. It doesn't make any difference.
Oh, okay. All right.
All right.
For an IRA, you need to be working.
Okay.
So you have to have earned income to qualify for an IRA.
Sure, and one other question. So that would then lower my the amount at the bottom of my first page of the 10,000.
That is correct. There is a $5,000 potential deduction. There is another amount for catch-up as well if you're over the age of 50 that you can also put an additional amount in.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Mary Lee in Kiel, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, how you doing? I have a question about my mother is 99, and the state has decided to withhold her tax refund. I guess now they're going to send it back because she did not get her ID information back to them soon enough, and they did this in 98 for the 2013 taxes as well, and she got it all in time, but she was ill this summer, and my daughter, who handles her finances, also had a very sick husband, so some of this got, you know, delayed, and they were going to deny her refund because she didn't get her ID in.
You know what?
Okay.
Here we are. We need to take a quick break. So let's all hold on to that question, and we'll be back with our guest right after a look at the news. Well, it won't be long before tax day is with us, about 4 months away, and got some help for you today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Mary Mellum, tax professional from Green Bay, Wisconsin, who's been in the tax business for about 30 years. She and her husband, David, operate Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals out of Green Bay. And it's always great to have her come by and talk with you and with me about taxes. Join in with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And as we broke for news, we had Mary Lee on from Kiel, who has a 99-year-old grandmother, I believe.
I think what your issue was is your mother probably received, when she filed her tax return, she probably received a letter from the state of Wisconsin requesting that she verify who she was in order to facilitate the continuation to finishing out the return. Wisconsin had a program the last 2 years where they were contacting people shortly after they filed their return to make sure that the person was indeed that person and this wasn't an identity theft issue.
Correct.
And if you did not do it in that time period, they held up the refund. The only way that I know to do that is to make contact with the state of Wisconsin and to prove to them that your mother is who she is.
Yes, and we did that. She did that on her own last year in 2014.
Okay.
But then they did it 2 years in a row, and when I talked to the state, they said, oh, it's because of the computer pulls people out, and we have no control over it. And this last summer, she was ill, and my son-in-law was ill, and the paperwork didn't get done. And now my daughter's taking over, and she will get it back eventually, we have been told. But the whole point is we were just caught flat-footed by the whole thing.
Well, the state of Wisconsin has announced this program, and they offer the ability to do it online as well as calling up or doing it by mail. So your mother's situation is an unfortunate situation, and it has happened to other people who are not have the ability to do it. But knowing that the program is out there and that it probably will happen again this year is maybe to keep an eye out for that piece of paper and turn it in right away.
Yep, absolutely. Thanks, Mary Lee. So it just kind of lets everybody else know. And I suppose if there's somebody who's 99 years old, there's a, you know, all right, is this person really still living and still, you know, actually there?
The part of the thing is identity thieves don't care who they target. It can be a baby who probably doesn't have anything out there. But what better source than a senior citizen to target them for identity theft, and that's what they're trying to protect.
Dustin in Richland Center has a question. Hi, Dustin.
Hey, how's it going today?
Great.
I'm 20. I actually just turned 21 yesterday. And
happy
I just
birthday.
Got married. Thank you. And I just got married last weekend. And then I bought a house in, it was probably April. And it was kind of a funny situation. The people I bought from were still living in the house, and they were buying a house with somebody else. And they were renting from me. It was, so they rented the house until October. And basically they were just paying my payments. And if it, I don't know if the price of the house or whatever matters. But I was just wondering what all I was going to want to make sure of when I was filing my taxes this year between getting married and buying a house.
You've had a big year.
Big year for sure, Dustin.
It was indeed, yes.
Okay.
My year in review came up on Facebook, and it was a pretty big year for me.
I would say so. Well, you have a couple of things going on. Most married couples file joint returns. So if there is no reason when you get into that you wouldn't want to file a joint return, then you would need your income sources and your spouse's income source. From the house standpoint, you purchased it in April, and if it was continuing to be lived in by the owner, I'm assuming that they either paid you money or paid something for you, like the mortgage on the house.
Yes, they paid my full house payment, so it was basically like I wasn't even owning the house yet.
Okay,
just
but
pay
when
me
you,
and then I take
when
the money
they
to
the say,
bank.
When you say they paid your full house payment, was this sold on a land contract, or did you have an actual loan with the bank that was in your name?
The loan was in my name in the bank.
Okay, so they're paying the bank is another way of them sending you the check and you sending it to the bank. What that means is that you are a landlord between April and October, and you would be claiming this income on a Schedule E, and the income would be the amount of money that they sent to the bank in your name.
Okay.
And then you would have expenses against that, the interest on the loan from April to October. I'm assuming that after October they moved out and you and your wife moved in.
Correct.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And from that point you have converted it from a rental property into a personal residence.
Correct.
So from that point on, the interest on the mortgage becomes the interest on your personal residence. Mm-hmm. From the point from April to October, it's interest on a rental. And then you have property taxes that you may have paid in that period of time. You have insurance. You have other upkeep that you would have on that house. So you would be filing a Schedule E as a rental property for this year. And if you continue to live in the house, it's going to be a one-time shot that
yep.
you have that.
Mm-hmm. There you
so,
go.
So when I'm filing my taxes, what am I looking for it to say that I need to put in?
Schedule E.
A Schedule E.
Mm-hmm.
Schedule E is for rental property. It's rental and...
You're likely also going to have a Schedule A, depending.
Yeah, so Schedule A is going to depend on how many other things that you have, because your mortgage interest is going to be very small in terms of the part that is personal. The larger portion of that rental, of the mortgage interest, will be rental and go on Schedule E.
You know, this might be one of those times, Mary, where Dustin takes a look at that small amount and say, you know what, maybe I just pay that next year and take it. It may have more impact if...
It may be better for him, but there was probably some place when... I think what you're talking about is the Wisconsin credit for property taxes. Keep in mind, though, that Dustin and his wife lived someplace before October.
Oh, yeah.
And they would also have either rent credit or another property tax credit for that period of time.
Yeah.
So it all depends on what's best. I, again, would suggest that you talk to a professional to make sure that you get things straightened out correctly for this year.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Busy guy in 2015. He's going to look back on 2015 with hopefully a lot of fondness.
We hope so.
Yep, we hope so. Arlene in Burlington. How about you? Hi.
I have a question about 529s and custodial accounts. We have custodial accounts which we transfer appreciated stock into for our grandchildren for their college. As I understand it, a 529 can only accept cash, which could be written off as a tax deduction, whereas I can't in a custodial. Am I correct, or is there any other options?
No, your custodial accounts, you were setting up those as, I think you mean a uniform gift to minors account?
I guess so, yes.
This account actually is in the child's name for with you as the custodian.
Correct.
Okay. And that account can have anything it wants to hold. And you're correct that there is no deduction. It is not a 529 plan. So if you wanted to convert that account into a 529, technically the proceeds would have to be, the property would have to be sold. Now, the other thing that you might want to think about, in this uniform gift to minors account, that money now belongs to that child. You have control of the money until they reach the age of majority, which is usually 18.
Yeah.
And at that point, that money is theirs.
Yeah.
So in a custodial account, when they reach that age, they technically could use that money for anything but college if they wanted to. And the other part of that is the custodial account has tax ramifications. It is taxable to the child whose Social Security number appears on the account. And so if that money were converted into a 529, it would technically be converted into a 529 with that child's name on it, not yours. There, a child can have a 529, a parent or a grandparent or a relative can have a 529 and have a child as the beneficiary. But since that money in the custodial account is theirs, if it were converted to the 529, it would be the child's 529, which means they technically don't have control over it.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right. And the other question of that, one of the grandchildren could probably qualify for some Pell Grants, whereas that by that time it may throw her out of eligibility for that.
And that's a possibility. With the grant situation or the financial aid situation, they base it more heavily on what is in the child's name as opposed to in the parent's name.
Oh, okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. That's better. Would I be smarter as they got to college age is to sell it out and make it into a 529 at that point? The stock is the dividends are amazing. So I really don't want to sell it into cash now.
Are you intending to put any more money away for the children, or is that your nest egg that you've given to them?
No, we give it to them every twice a year. And it's from, accumulated stock with very good dividends.
Sure.
So it is accumulating.
I guess you're kind of in a catch-22. Maybe you might want to consider using the dividends. Do you reinvest the dividends in the stock?
Yes.
Okay. You might want to consider not reinvesting the dividends and taking the dividends out and putting the dividends into the 529 plan and maybe leaving the stock in the other plan. It might be a way rather than having to sell the stock, because the actual stock is not going to be able to go into the 529 plan.
No, yeah. Just hoping that it had changed, but I guess not.
No, they haven't changed it. The two are completely distinct animals.
Thanks, Arlene. Appreciate your call. And, more callers online. You can join in, 800-642-1234. Let's go to Susan in Oshkosh next. Hi, Susan.
Hey, how's it going?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, I want to buy a Chevy Volt.
Uh-huh.
And there is, on the table right now, a $7,500 tax credit if you buy a a Chevy Volt, and this is the only one I've investigated. But I don't think I pay that much in taxes, so do you get the credit if you don't, you know, like a child tax credit, you get the credit even if you don't pay that much in taxes? But
I believe the Chevy Volt is a non-refundable credit.
So if I don't pay that much in tax,
if it's a non-refundable credit, you won't get it. You won't get it back.
Unless I pay the tax.
Unless you had tax due.
Right. So usually the way that I avoid paying taxes is I put a whole bunch of money in my IRA.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
How does that sort of compute then if I use the tax credit instead of
IRA? Are you're maximizing the IRA?
I'm putting right now like last year I put $6,500 for me and my spouse into an IRA.
Okay.
And I don't know. I'm just really having difficulty calculating.
Do you happen to know what tax bracket you're in?
I'm probably in a pretty low tax bracket.
Well, if you're in the 15% tax bracket, that $13,000 that you're putting away into the IRA would translate into a tax benefit of about $1,950. So not putting that money away, if you're in the 15% tax bracket, would only give you tax, result in extra tax of about $2,000. That's less than
$7,500.
The credit
the tax credit is really just for like really rich people then.
not necessarily, but that I can't give you an answer right off the top. I'd have to do a little bit of a more looking as far as the tax credits, you know, that's one of the only vehicles that's left. We did have some tax credits with the electric vehicle and things, or the other cars, the hybrids and things like that a few years ago, but it isn't one that that I know a lot about off the top of my head without looking.
Ah, there we go. Thanks, Susan, for calling. Along the vehicle line, question from Buck in Sturgeon Bay, who has a personal vehicle and a business vehicle. He says, I'd like to just have one car. How complicated would it be to use my business vehicle as my personal vehicle as well?
The tax ramifications, he would probably be the same. It is keeping track of the records that is the bigger part of it. There is a deduction for the business side of it. Usually people take the standard mileage rate. There is no deduction for the personal side. So he would have to have very good records of how much personal use versus business use. And if that's the case, he should be fine.
I remember I had to do that for a year when I was in Trinidad at the University of the West Indies. And so I had a ledger in the vehicle, and if it was business, I would have to write it down. Okay, these 10 miles or whatever were for business, and then if I went to a movie or something in the evening, well, there's 4 miles of that don't count.
And the factors are that people have to keep logs. They start out by keeping the mileage at the beginning of the year, and you log the mileage at the end of the year so you know your total mileage. And then each time, like you said, each time you do a business trip, you have to log the mileage that's business and the time, place, and business purpose of it. Today, with the technology the way it is, there are apps out there that you can do those things with that are, for some people, are better than the spiral notebook that you talked about.
Yeah, well, this was a few years back.
Well, the apps have been of recent. So, but there are ways to do it. If you are disciplined enough to do it, you don't need to have two vehicles, but you've got to keep track to get the benefits.
Yeah, there we go. Donald in Darlington. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, Larry, hey, I got a question. I was in the Obama exchanges.
Okay.
And I've tried it twice. I keep getting priced out because of financial issues. I have multiple jobs. So the government keeps pulling me away
okay.
as they're kicking in.
Let me understand. Let me understand. You're having trouble getting the insurance?
No.
She's getting dropped.
But I'm getting priced out of it. So I've ended up dropping it. Now, how much of a fine am I looking at after the first?
Okay. This year's penalty is there's a two-part penalty or a two-place. There is a flat dollar penalty, and there is a percentage of income penalty, and you pay the greater when you don't have insurance. The penalty this year, the flat dollar is $325. Are you single or are there other people?
Single.
Okay. So it is the greater of $325 or 2% of your household income, which is basically bottom line of the front page of your 1040. So that's the worst case scenario that you have.
Well, I mean, I've tried it. And
pardon me?
That's to pay. I've tried it. And what they want is like more than, I mean, I don't have $400 or $500 laying around.
Sure. Yeah. And you're bringing up some very valid points. But what I would recommend is that when you fill out your taxes, it's going to say, did you have health insurance for these months? And if you had them, you're going to get a document, and I'm really glad you asked this question today, because there is a document coming out from the government that is a 1095A that will show if you were covered at all under the Obamacare during the year. And that will tell you the months that you were covered. You would be responsible for paying a penalty for the months that you weren't covered unless you're able to come up with an exemption. And there are a number of exceptions or exemptions.
And with that, you should take a look at that. And with that, Mary, we are completely out of time. Thank you so much for being with us today. And I look forward to your next visit. I really appreciate your time.
You are very welcome.
Mary Mellum, tax professional with Ashwaubenon Tax Professionals of Green Bay. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.